From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Writer Ellen Rappaport was excited to pitch her 1970s workplace comedy, Minx. The series would follow an idealistic young Vassar graduate who teams up with a pornographer. And together, they create a magazine that features feminist articles alongside photos of naked men. Rappaport had Bridesmaids director Paul Feig signed on as a producer, and she'd done tons of research on 70s porn and feminism. She was pretty sure this was a slam dunk.
We took it to everyone, every buyer, buyers I didn't even know existed, networks I've never heard of. And everyone said no. Everyone said no.
We talked to Ellen Rappaport about how Minx and its plethora of penises found a home on HBO Max. But first, we banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, I think the world is now divided into people who are very tired of talking about Slapgate and people who still have things to say about it. But as you know, late last week, Will Smith resigned from the Academy. You and I had talked about this, and I had said before he did that I thought they were going to expel him. At that moment, you were like thinking maybe he'd be suspended, but maybe you came to see that I think people were more outraged than you initially were thinking.
Yeah, I don't know that he would have been expelled. I still think the most likely scenario would have been that he would have been suspended for anywhere from 1 to 5 years. But this resignation is really more of a symbolic gesture. Yes, he cannot vote for the Oscars in the future. He won't get screeners. But this doesn't take away his right to be nominated. It doesn't take away his right to attend the Oscars in the future. So I think the Academy still here has to make a statement and go there and say, you know what, this is unacceptable behavior and you will not participate in any Academy activities going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be an ongoing debate, but maybe it will be slightly less public and maybe Will Smith did the Academy and himself a favor by just precluding, you know, the back and forth to some degree. I mean, I'm sure we'll still hear a bit about what went on inside the room. And you know that Academy has a huge board. The board is, you know, like I think 50 plus. And getting them to agree on what time it is hard. And we have a subset that are disgruntled about the way, you know, the people who were not presented live during the telecast are mad. So I don't know what it's going to be like in that room. I guess I have to say at this point, you know, I would say the Academy has suffered almost as much reputational damage as Will Smith by their handling of it. And I just want to review what I call the four steps of what made this so egregious. There was the slap itself, which was, of course, unacceptable. The cursing on television, which from a person who's been on TV almost his whole life, also completely out of unacceptable. And then there was his speech, which was, I thought, extremely strange and self-justifying and really made me wonder if he was okay. And I'm sure a lot of others felt the same. And then there finally was the dancing at the Vanity Fair party as if he had not a care in the world to his own music, which looked completely arrogant and tone deaf. So I think that protracted scenario does force the kind of thing that you are talking about, but makes it also, you know, consensus might be hard to find.
You know, and the thing that Will Smith actually does care about is his career. So now this gesture is the first step in what I'm sure is a plan that his representatives have laid out to rehabilitate himself so he can have that career going forward. And there was a study that Morning Consult put out this week where they surveyed people about the favorability of Will Smith, and it did drop about 30% from a previous study to the Monday or Tuesday after the Oscars, but he's still at about 50% favorability. So half the country has a favorable opinion of him even after this. So it's not like he is a pariah that is going to be banished. There is a path back here. And I think resigning from the Academy is the first step. He needs to make concrete efforts to rehab his image, whether that means donating to charities or showing up at different anti-violence events or simply going away for a little bit, I think will help him as well. And there is a path back.
I think so. You know, Apple is the one that's got a completed film, this Emancipation slave drama that was supposed to be released this year. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't release it this year or very late this year. It's an awards play. I think that's where Will Smith may have the most trouble, actually. You know, half the country may be okay with him, but a lot of people in the Academy are not. And, you know, a couple of people have told me they would never vote for him for an award again.
Right, but the question is, on those bigger blockbuster movies that he does occasionally still, like the Bad Boys sequels, if you're Sony, are you going to bet $150 million on a Bad Boys 4, knowing that Will Smith has this issue that is going to cloud the promotion and perhaps the perception of him?
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be a pause. I know they were in the midst. They had a concept he liked. They'd sent him pages. The first script is a work in progress. I think Sony would say they're not. They're going straight ahead, or nothing was paused because nothing was really that far along. But I am told by a reliable source that they're just going to hold off a bit and let him do this path back. And then they can talk about maybe, I mean, Bad Boys 4 is a very commercial property. So, you know, nobody gives up a franchise willingly these days. No studio.
Yeah. And that's what's interesting here is that, you know, with Tom Cruise and his couch jumping exercise, he had a franchise in Mission Impossible that allowed him to come back after being essentially ostracized for a while. And if you look at someone like Mel Gibson, who obviously had his meltdown, he was able to lean on his directing career to bring him back. And he's no longer a movie star in the traditional sense, but he does work. And he's had, you know, there has been a path back for him. Will Smith doesn't have that. I mean, you talk about Bad Boys, but Bad Boys is not an A-list franchise. It was only recently relaunched. So it is a little bit harder there because he's got to rely on new properties each time, unless maybe he goes back to Men in Black or something like that.
Well, he does have a producing career, don't forget. I mean, you know, one thing is this company, Kevin Mayer and Tom Staggs have this new company that bought the Reese Witherspoon company and invested in Will Smith's company. They, you know, are counting on him to be a star and produce. And we don't know whether, you know, there's also an issue with Will Smith as a producer because, you know, everybody has to stand on the red carpet and there will always be questions about Slapgate for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, the producing career, I think, is a big question mark at this point.
Let me turn to Disney. We all know that Bob Chapek, the CEO, had a tremendous problem. He initially did not want to take a position on the Florida Don't Say Gay legislation, so-called. He pivoted 180 degrees on that and ultimately apologized. Disney has, as we've talked about, a very big gay staff, and also people who aren't gay feel passionately about this as well. This has opened the door to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis calling Disney woke, and it has given Fox News a chance to go. As we speak right now, they have brought it up 250 times on Fox News, woke Disney, in the past 24 hours. I'm sure there's a lot they don't want to talk about, like Ginny Thomas and her text to Mark Meadows and that kind of thing, which they don't touch much. They are having a field day with this because it fits very much into their culture war brand.
And that's what Fox News does. They turn on the spigot and, you know, the story is nonstop. And it's having an impact. I mean, you look on Twitter and boycott Disney is trending on Twitter. It's interesting because obviously there's a bit of irony here in that the effort by Bob Chapek to steer Disney into the center and away from some of the left-leaning positions has had the opposite impact and has turned Disney into this lightning rod of the right. And, it more so than when it was simply taking positions on the left under Bob Iger.
I think there are two questions for me, one of which is, if Bob Chapek had tried to thread this needle from the start, would it have enabled him to avoid the controversy? If he had said from the start that Disney opposes this because other corporations have, obviously Disney is special, maybe he could have avoided it. I don't know. And the other side of that is, are we simply at a point of such cultural toxicity that he could not win this one? Like, which comes first, the waffling or the agenda of the right, which is to pass this kind of legislation?
I think that if they had just stayed the course under Iger and said, yes, we oppose this, it would have been like, oh, of course they do. And it wouldn't have been a story. I think because of the flip-flop, it opened the door.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. The new HBO Max show Minx is a comedy about the creation of the first women's erotic magazine. Set in the early 1970s, Minx follows an idealistic young woman, Joyce, played by Ophelia Lovibond, as she starts out with a dream of creating a magazine for feminists. She takes the idea to a convention center full of publishers to make the pitch.
This country treats women like second-class citizens. We're overlooked, underpaid, and overwhelmed. We deserve a magazine that inspires us. It shows us how to fight. Gentlemen, this is your chance to be on the right side of history. The matriarchy awakens.
Why is she so angry?
Nobody's buying what Joyce is selling, but before long, she finds an unlikely partner in pornographer Doug, who sees the promise in her idea if she's willing to add pictures of nude men. And so the magazine Minx is born. Minx, the HBO Max series, comes from the mind of showrunner Ellen Rappaport. She's been a working writer in Hollywood for decades, but this is her first time helming a show. Years ago, she started off far from Hollywood, attending Harvard Law School before starting a career as a corporate lawyer. I guess you did law school like so many people did, just by got to do something. And this is a career, respectable, sort of. Right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I had immigrant parents. I grew up in the Midwest. I didn't know that TV writing was something that people did professionally. Yeah, law school, it's positioned as this very general career, but it's actually not. It's incredibly specific. So I think that's possibly why there are so many unhappy lawyers.
Yeah. I would write about law firms, and some of the young associates would always say to me, I'm only doing this for a couple of years to bank the money, and then I'm out because this is just deadly. And then, like, fast forward 15 years, they're still sitting
there. Are
they
still there? No. Yeah. So I don't have any friends from law school who are still lawyers.
Oh, okay.
I know. They all escaped. They fled. One of my friends is on the Supreme Court of California, which is funny to think that if I had done things differently, I could have ended up there. Although don't think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, everyone left.
That makes me feel better because I felt like so many people just didn't know what else to do with themselves. But you were writing scripts. You were at some big white shoe law firm.
Yeah, I was a summer associate at Skadden. And then I was an associate at Paul Weiss, which are really big corporate white shoe law firms. And I think I was a terrible lawyer. I was writing on the side, but I mean, I would say 90% of it is my fault. I would say 10% of it was we weren't really told what we were supposed to be doing. I remember we didn't have orientation until 6 months in. And it was at that point that I found out that the most junior person on the case was responsible for keeping a physical record of every email, every conversation, every brief that was filed in their case.
Oops.
Exactly. Yeah, no, for 6 months, I just kept getting CC'd on things and things would be delivered to my office. And I was like, why are they sending me this? I have no idea. This isn't the part of the case that I'm working on.
Well, so you, I think you sold a movie script, right? Was that the first thing that you...
I did. I sold a movie script while I was still a lawyer, which should tell you a little bit about what kind of a lawyer I was, that I had time to do a movie script.
Right. So, I mean, you're working at a New York firm. You know, people always want to know, how do you get somebody to read the script? How did you do it?
I really randomly just called agents and got people to talk to me on the phone. I don't know why they did it. But ultimately, I think a friend from law school had a friend who was an assistant at William Morris, and that person read the script and liked it and passed it on to their boss. And that's how I got an agent. And the script actually sold because a friend of mine, she was from LA. Her husband was working at a studio. She was reading it and laughing, and he asked to see it. I think I had sent it to her for notes. So, you know, she let him read it and then he bought it.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's not like a real pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind of story. It's a story of privilege and connections, unfortunately.
So do you sell the script and say, I'm out of here. Goodbye, Manhattan.
They flew me to LA and put me up. And I was working with the director on the script. And after several months, I just decided to move here.
And I don't think that movie actually got made in the end, did it?
No.
Welcome to Hollywood.
I have a whole graveyard of projects that never got made.
How did you stick with it when you said you have a whole graveyard? Because I would imagine it gets discouraging.
Well, I mean, they say, isn't there that quote? Hollywood is the, you know, you can die of encouragement. What's that great quote?
I don't know. It's good though.
I think that I was always selling things and always getting jobs, always doing rewrites. And so I have no other talents. So I just stuck with it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you can have a whole career here and never have a thing get made. I knew somebody who worked for years and made money, but nothing got made.
Yeah, I have friends with exorbitant quotes who have never had anything made. Yeah, it's a strange and frustrating career path. But, you know, that's the beauty of having been a corporate lawyer, is that nothing is worse than being a lawyer. So it gives you a little perspective.
So let's talk about how you got to this one. Let's start with the idea.
I read an article about, I actually can't even remember anymore if it was Viva or Playgirl, but I read an article about one of these magazines, one of these erotic magazines for women that sprung up in the 70s. And what immediately struck me, well, it was a few things. The first thing is I didn't realize that these were feminist magazines, which is just something that I thought was interesting. And secondly, I learned that these workplaces were largely populated by a collection of feminists and pornographers. And that just seemed like a rich idea for a TV show, frankly. And I started researching the magazines and, you know, they themselves are just fascinating cultural artifacts, just of a time when magazines really meant something to people and, you know, created water cooler moments, changed the conversation. And, you know, when people had attention spans, these magazines had, you know, really long articles that were well-researched about abortion and rape, sexual harassment, you know, emotional labor, the decision to have or to not have kids. And an interspersed would just be a man naked on a horse. And to be honest, it like took me a while to really understand what the purpose was. And, you know, what I ultimately came to, which is something that I tried to put in the pilot, is that, you know, it really was this kind of stepping stone in terms of feminism. It felt like they were doing it because men could see women naked and now women could see men naked. And it was kind of like the first step and the first building block into, I think, what eventually became much more of a conversation.
Mm. So I know Paul Feig is involved with it, but I'm not sure when you, let's just go from idea to starting to pitch the idea.
You know, I did a lot of research. I researched kind of the magazines of the era, and I then rejected the idea of basing it too much on one of these magazines because I think the people who worked there were not clean characters. If you actually look at the history of these magazines, like their messaging seemed to change all the time. To me, it felt like, you know, to really do a TV show and to make it feel like I wanted to make it feel, I would have to create a world from scratch. And I also, you know, as you might imagine, did a lot of research on second wave feminism and everything that was happening historically in the 70s. And, you know, I think if you read enough of that stuff and it doesn't enrage you, it's surprising because, you know, it felt like both in the magazines and just everything historically that we were just revisiting all the same issues that we were talking about 50 years ago. And in a way, there had been so much progress, but in so many other ways, it felt like nothing had changed and we were just having the same conversation. So, you know, that told me, other than making me mad, it felt like it would be a really good way to make a period piece that wasn't an artifact. And it was examining this decade through a modern lens.
Coming up after a short break, Ellen Rappaport describes taking her vision for Minx from idea to pitch, a pitch that got a lot of no's. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The new HBO Max series Minx starts out with aspiring writer Janice, played by Ophelia Lovibond, pitching her idea for a feminist magazine at a publishing conference. Porn publisher Doug, played by New Girl star Jake Johnson, jumps in to critique her sales pitch.
Hey, if it were me, I'd stop bragging about how different I was from the most successful women's magazines in, oh, I don't know, forever. I would say that I was just like them, you know, but with a twist.
Yeah, well, maybe that'll work on you, but I'm looking for a different kind of publisher.
Oh, yeah? And what kind is that?
The kind who doesn't fetishize lactating mothers.
After some lively debate, Janice and Doug join forces to create Minx, with articles about the pay gap and women's rights woven in with male nudes. The first episode of Minx features a joyful montage as Janice and her coworkers get to work casting the perfect package for their first centerfold. Showrunner Ellen Rappaport wrote the pilot for her new show after reading lots of old issues of Playgirl and Ms. Magazine. Then it came time to try to make the show come to life.
I gave it to my agents, and they set up a bunch of meetings with their pods, and I think people were interested, but the chemistry wasn't quite right. I had worked with Jesse Henderson, who was working with Paul Feig at the time. We had developed a screenplay when she was at Chernin, and I brought it to her. And she really liked the idea and, you know, got Paul on board. And Paul, you know, remembered Playgirl coming to town and what a big deal it was. And then we took it to Lionsgate. Lionsgate wanted to do it. And then we took it to everyone, every buyer. Buyers I didn't even know existed. Networks I've never heard of. Everyone said no.
Well, that was discouraging.
Everyone said no. It was a weird pitch.
It was a weird pitch?
It was discouraging, and I think I was a little... It's a weird pitch, yeah. It's like, I thought it was a layup, truly. I thought we were going to have a bidding war, and everyone would want it. And then, you know, I walked in, and it was like, I have a really expensive period piece that's about pornography and feminism at the same time, but it's going to feel sweet and kind of heartwarming, and you're going to root for a feminist to go into porn. And it's about male nudity.
Right.
So I think the pitch went well, but like people enjoyed sitting there and listening to it, I think, or at least pretended to. And we got truly lovely passes. They were so nice about it. But Sarah Aubrey was the only one who bought it. She bought it in the middle of the pitch. I didn't even have to finish.
Wow. But HBO, she was at HBO Max at that point.
She was actually at TNT.
Oh, at TNT.
And
yeah, and how is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, nobody was showing... Well, first of all, they were the Naked Network. Like, they actually had so much nudity in that show, Animal Kingdom.
Mm.
Not penises.
Right, so not penises.
Mm-hmm. And no one was really showing male nudity at the time on television. So to be honest, I wasn't 100% sure that anybody would let us make it with genitalia. And Sarah was just so smart and got it. And it was kind of like, I guess we'll figure it out. And she took it with her when she went to HBO Max. It was, you know, obviously easier over there because they don't have the same kinds of restrictions.
Would you have been willing to do it without? I mean, I read you pitched it to NBC, which is definitely not going to do male genitalia or anybody's genitalia or even a breast. So,
I mean, honestly, I probably would have done it that way. I think it's still a good idea for a show. I think it wouldn't have been as good.
What is it about seeing the penises that you felt so that had to happen? Why, you know, why did we have to see it?
It just felt like a cheat to not see it. It felt like they're a porn company. You should have a lot of nudity. You should have women walking by in the background. You should have an audition scene where they test the concept. And I think that if you're really seeing the young woman, Joyce, as your doorway into the show, you really want to experience the world through her eyes. And that does involve seeing quite a bit of male nudity.
So you have intimacy coordinators on the set.
We do.
Because, I don't know, I guess, and I hear, you know, these sets are very locked down. I mean, any presumption that, maybe, is this true? Any presumption that men are more casual about that kind of stuff than women? Is that not true?
No, actually, if they are, they aren't, because we just follow the same protocols regardless of who it is. So it didn't seem like they were more casual about it. I think being nude on camera is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And even if you think it isn't, it's a lot to take off your clothes and have an entire camera crew there in KN95 masks filming it. It really is.
So what is the function of the intimacy coordinator? What do they do?
So the intimacy coordinator is the go-between between the actor and the director and showrunner. And I think that before anything is shot or anyone is on set, she has a conversation with them to kind of figure out their boundaries, what they are or are not comfortable doing, talk through the scene, you know, parameters, what the expectation is, and, you know, just any issues that they might have or anything that comes up, she's really there to handle it.
So you mentioned that when you're reading articles from the 70s porn, it's disheartening that women are dealing with so many of the same issues now. And I mean, what are the ones that really struck you? And I imagine you were discouraged, surprised, whatever, not happy to read that.
Yeah. Some of them, you know, a lot of them were from Ms., which I also read, which had, I would say, the better written version of these stories. And even in the first issue of Ms., you know, there's a famous article about women having a click moment and where it clicks into them how the division of labor in their house has been incredibly unfair. And it felt like, you know, I'm a mom, I have kids, I know a lot of women who maybe left careers to take care of their kids who are having these exact same conversations, feeling like they're doing the brunt of the work. And why is it incumbent on the women to take care of everything child-related? You know, why are we the ones who get the birthday party invitations? Why aren't the men added? You know, why are the women the ones who get the phone calls from the school when there's a problem? Why is that the first call that they make? And so it felt like a bummer that that was a conversation that was happening in 1972.
Mm.
And then I think a lot of the articles about the sexism within the medical industry seemed like things that women are still talking about now. With, I think now we're talking a lot too about the racism of the medical industry. And I'm, you know, I think these magazines were very much white women magazines, so I don't think they covered that topic, but I think they're all part and parcel of the same thing.
Right.
Which is this disinclination by the medical industry to take women seriously.
So I gather you feel like you would love to be able to take this series into the 80s.
Yeah, 12 seasons.
Sure.
That's all I'm asking for.
I mean, they don't do that in streaming so much anymore, but there are exceptions, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, I think the 80s are just an interesting decade. I just think what happened societally was fascinating. And I just wonder how we went from being this very freewheeling country in, you know, the mid to late 70s to an incredibly conservative country. These magazines historically fell out of favor around then because I think women seemed to no longer be interested really in exploring their sexuality, at least in terms of buying the magazines. Like, it just became this very consumerist, conservative decade. And I would love to see Doug in 1982.
Where is he? Where will his career take him? And Joyce, too, I assume, right?
Too.
We don't want to leave her.
No, we don't want to leave her hanging. She seems more of a clear trajectory to me in 1982. I feel like I see her in a power suit.
Ellen Rappaport is the creator and showrunner of Minx on HBO Max. Thank you, Ellen, for joining us.
Thank you. It was so nice talking to you.
And that's The Business. Melissa Yeager-Miller produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.